Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time on Wednesday, the day before Thanksgiving. Tomorrow we'll have a recorded broadcast just because, well, it's Thanksgiving. I don't expect anyone to be calling the program while they're eating with their families or visiting with their families, so we will not bother you with begging for calls tomorrow. But today, you can call in, and you may want to, since it'll be a couple days before you can do so in the future. The number is 1-800-438-5090. If you've never heard the program before, this is just straight question and answer format. If you have a question about the Bible or Christianity or anything related to those topics, I'd be glad to talk to you. You can also call if you've heard the program before, you've heard something you disagree with. Or maybe today you'll hear something you disagree with coming from this host and you would like to balance comment. That'll be more than welcome here, so give me a call, 1-800-438-5090. Our first caller today is Bruce, calling from Las Vegas, Nevada. Bruce, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me, Steve. This is about the second coming of Christ, and then I wanted to get your view and how you've interpreted out of the Bible again, so I can get straight on it, because, you know, a lot of people go with a dispensationalist view, am I correct in saying a guy started that, read into that, or started that up in the 1800s?
Yes, in 1830, a guy named John Nelson Darby.
Okay, so, you know, that concerns me right there, kind of a red flag for me, but I wanted to get your view again, because I'm starting to go that way with it after reading Matthew again, after reading Thessalonians, taking a look at Daniel. I just want to touch base with you, because what I like that you're independent, that you go through the Bible and you're not tied to a religion, and I think that's where we need to be with this. So we're... There is a second coming of Christ. That is our hope. Yet, I mean, we could be deceased and already be with him, or we could be alive and he could come today. But where I'm going with this is, how about, you know, because the dispensationalist view is there's going to be a rapture and this and that. Now, we had the fall of Jerusalem in 70 A.D., Now, was Jesus referring to that in Matthew, that, okay, that was going to be the tribulation, or is there another tribulation to come before Jesus' second coming? I guess that's where my bottom line question is.
So your question has to do with, is there a tribulation in the future, or was it already fulfilled?
Exactly, Steve. That's what I need to know.
Well, of course, it depends on who you talk to, but as I understand it, the Bible teaches that Jesus is going to come back at the end of the world as we know it, and he will establish a new heavens and a new earth at that time. I don't believe there's a division between his coming for the saints and his coming with the saints, so I don't believe in a pre-tribulational or mid-tribulational rapture. I believe that the rapture occurs at the second coming. Now, as far as the tribulation is concerned, there's only two times in the Bible that we really read of the tribulation, or the great tribulation. Certainly the word tribulation occurs lots of times in the Bible, but it's usually generic. It usually just refers to trouble in general.
Okay.
But Jesus said in Matthew 24:21 that then there shall be great tribulation, such as has not been since the world began, nor neither shall be hereafter. And so that's one place that mentions a particular tribulation. He said it'll be great tribulation at that time. And then in Revelation chapter 7, verse 14, we also read, these are those who are coming up out of the great tribulation. So the great tribulation in Revelation 7:14 is no doubt the same great tribulation that Jesus spoke of in Matthew 24. Now, when is that tribulation? Is that future? First of all, I want to say that the most common view that you'll hear from dispensationalists is that the tribulation is 7 years long. And that it is in the future. Now, the Bible nowhere says that. There's no place in the Bible that speaks of a tribulation of 7 years. the idea that the tribulation is 7 years long comes from the identification of this great tribulation that Jesus speaks of, which Jesus does not assign to any particular length of time. People identify that with the 70th week of Daniel in Daniel chapter 9, verses 26 and 27. Okay. And they believe that it is a 7 year, the 70th week of Daniel is a future 7 year tribulation, they believe. Now, that identification is, in my mind, uncalled for. I don't believe it's correct. But the Bible does not mention anywhere how long the tribulation will be. The only tribulation that any length of time is mentioned of is in, actually, Revelation 2:10, where the church of Smyrna is told that they will have tribulation for 10 days. So there's a 10-day tribulation that was promised to the church of Smyrna in their own town. It's certainly not talking about the tribulation that Jesus was talking about that would be like none other. Now, in my opinion, if we would just look at what Jesus said about the Great Tribulation, we'll see that it starts out, it's in a conversation he has with his disciples, which occurred because he had predicted that the temple would be destroyed, and he predicted that not one stone would be left standing on another that would not be thrown down. That's in Matthew 24:2.
Mm-hmm.
And the disciples asked him about that. When will this happen? And what sign will there be, and so forth? Now,
when he said, most certainly this generation won't pass away before it happens.
Yes, he did say that. And so we know that the tribulation he's talking, or at least the destruction of Jerusalem he's talking about, happened in that generation. Now,
mm-hmm.
in the midst of that, he says, for then there will be great tribulation. This is Matthew 24:21. Then there shall be great tribulation. When? Well, it's related to the question he's talking about, when the Jews would come under attack, the attack that eventually would result in the destruction of their temple, which took place in AD 70 when they were at war with the Romans. So it seems to me that the Great Tribulation is associated with that event. Now, he doesn't say how long it is. Some people believe that the Great Tribulation is the 3.5 years that the Jews were at war with Rome from 66 to 70 AD. Some might think the Great Tribulation is simply the time during the siege of Jerusalem, which was only a few months long, before the Romans broke through and destroyed the city. It's also possible, though I don't know that this is to be a preferred view, but it's possible that the tribulation that has come on the Jews that is spoken of here is continuing to this day. In other words, that it's been through the whole era of the past 2,000 years. The Jews were scattered. Their temple was destroyed. Their temple is still destroyed, and they're still scattered.
Yeah, look, they had the Holocaust from Hitler and all.
Well, the Holocaust, the pogroms of in Russia and so forth, a lot of the things the Jews have suffered,
mm-hmm.
Very sadly, could
yes.
be part of this continuing tribulation that came upon them.
Interesting. All right, so it sounds like what Jesus was talking about happened in 70 A.D., that it's not a future thing, or like there's a couple possibilities, or it could be something they're still long-suffering right now.
Right. All I can say is there's no reason to believe that the tribulation that Jesus speaks of is something that has yet to begin.
Okay.
Yeah, it may have begun. It may have begun and continued for the past 2,000 years, or it may have begun and ended in the first century. But there's no reason to believe that it will begin in the future and that it has not yet begun.
Now, how did this gentleman Darby, is it?
John Nelson Darby. Yeah, Darby.
Yeah. How did Mr. Darby come up with this whole thing in the 1800s?
Well, he was a part of the Plymouth Brethren movement, which was a Bible studying movement. And he was in England, and the Anglican Church was... I think from what I understand, at least it was the view of the Brethren, that the Anglican Church was pretty spiritually dead and that it was not teaching people the Bible. And so a lot of Brethren were avid Bible students. Darby, I don't know how he decided to see it through the lens that he saw it through, but he began to feel that the traditional or the historical way the Church had seen the Scripture was wrong. And that he was seeing something different. And, of course, all the distinctives of dispensationalism are the things that he saw differently. I don't have time to go into all those.
No, I understand. I just was curious where that kind of stemmed from with him. So, well, thank you, Steve. You answered a big question there because I've been looking at all that, and I just see how the, you know, demoralization is, how things are. You know, I'm not trying to be, down, but things are getting worse. I mean, as far as how people treat each other and how things are right now.
Well, things are getting worse in our time than they were
time.
Than they have ever been in our time.
Yes.
They're not worse.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, they're not worse today than they've ever been.
No, we're not living by the sword. I mean, we
right.
have indoor plumbing and whatnot,
that's right.
so. But in our time, yeah.
We don't have slavery.
We don't have slavery.
Human rights, enforcement mm-hmm. and so forth. Yeah, so, I mean, there's a lot of things in our time that are better than any time prior to, say, the 19th century. But truly, things are worse in our time by many measures than they have ever been in our time.
Yeah. Yes. Well, God bless you, Steve, and I hope you have a happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you, Bruce. God bless you.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks for your call. Bye now.
Thanks.
All right. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We have a line open for you if you'd like to call me right now. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Kyle from Minneapolis, Minnesota is our next caller. Kyle, thanks for waiting. Good to hear from you.
Hey, good to talk to you, Steve. My question today is, I'm just curious in your thoughts on the Passion of the Christ and just kind of similar things, you know, Christian drama and other, I don't know, that sort of media. What do you think of that?
You mean should Jesus be depicted by movie actors?
Yeah, but more than that, too, just, I mean, can that movie be really like, I mean, it was moving for me before I was saved. I've only seen it once. But, you know, I've kind of considered watching it again from a Christian perspective and
uh-huh.
stuff. And I don't know. I don't know if I should even seek that out.
Well, as far as that particular movie is concerned, I thought it had a lot of merit. There were some things in it that were not in the Bible. I mean, in other words, there was some license that Mel Gibson took. He brought in some Catholic tradition. He also brought in some things from some mystical Catholic ladies who believed without biblical authority that certain things happened. So he included some of those in the movie. There were things about the movie I didn't care for. In general, I have mixed feelings about movies that depict Jesus. The problem is, of course, that every actor in any movie on any subject, every actor has to interpret the character that he's portraying. And so an actor has to interpret Jesus. There was that movie from the Gospel of Matthew with Bruce Marciano as Jesus that really was a very different interpretation of the character of Jesus, where this particular actor was part of the Vineyard movement during the time that the Toronto Blessing was going on with all the laughter and everything like that. And he depicted Jesus as continually laughing. And it was kind of interesting. It was interesting to see Jesus as cheerful and winsome and so forth as he depicted him in the movie. But it was certainly different than anyone had ever depicted him before. And it got me thinking, I wonder how... Okay, either all the actors who played Jesus before have gotten him wrong, and this is more like the way he was, or else this particular actor has got him wrong, and the others were closer to the truth. But in any case, somebody, and we don't know who, has depicted Jesus radically wrong. That is, they have depicted Jesus different than he really is. Now, I don't know that Jesus is so thin-skinned that he'd be offended by people who, you know, with a sincere heart are trying their best to represent him to the world. But at the same time, the objective fact remains that when some people see a movie where Jesus is depicted, they're going to get the idea, I mean, that's going to be the picture of Jesus that will be in their mind. And if it's not really the way he really is, well, then they're going to have a false image of Jesus in their head. Now, someone might say, well, with or without movies about Jesus, everyone has their own imaginary image of Jesus in their head. Just, you know, when they read the Gospels, if two actors reading the Gospels can interpret Jesus differently from each other, certainly two individuals just reading the Gospels can get the wrong picture of Jesus also. And that is true. That is true. But, you know, one thing is that the older you get and the more you meditate on the Scriptures and the more you actually get to know Jesus, the more your views of who he is can really improve, can actually be modified in the right direction. But a picture is worth a thousand words, and when someone sees a human actor depicting Jesus, it's a little hard to get that picture out of their head. It's so much harder to move from a visual image, that is, that you've actually seen with your eyes depicted, than from a mental image that's kind of vague and fluid and which can change. So I'm not coming out lambasting the whole enterprise of making movies about Jesus. I'm just saying those are concerns I've always had about it. As far as your concern that you saw the Passion of the Christ before you were a Christian and you're wondering whether you should see it again, I'd say if it was moving to you beforehand, you should see it again. And, you know, you can let me know if it still moves you as a Christian. I went and saw it. Although I have to say I'm kind of squeamish. I had to shut my eyes for a few parts because of the gore in it. But again, I don't enjoy gory depictions. Although I'm not opposed to the fact that they were included. It's just it was not out of conscience that I closed my eyes. It was just out of squeamishness. But I mean, that no doubt is a good depiction of what Jesus went through. But whether it's a good depiction of the personality of Christ, I cannot say. And I felt particularly that the depiction of his mother was not very realistic. The actress who played Mary, I think, I don't know, she must have been a Catholic. I know Mel Gibson's a Catholic, and they have an idea of Mary that's somewhat, I guess, superhuman, almost goddess-like. And I felt like the Mary in the movie was not showing any of the real emotion that a real mother would show seeing her son whipped like that. She was shown to be, of course, upset, but I can't imagine a mother having as much composure watching that happen to her son as the Mary in the movie did. And I think that that's kind of, that probably stems from the idea that Mary is not really like any other mother. She's kind of almost godlike and has, you know, kind of above it all. I'm sure Roman Catholics don't think of her as being above it all, but the depiction didn't strike me as a very realistic depiction of how Mary would have acted.
Can I ask another question related to this?
Okay.
Jesus, of course, was quite, I mean, not only suffering the wound in his side and on his hands and his feet, he obviously suffered other wounds from the scourging. And I'm wondering, when he appeared to the disciples, and, you know, we've got, of course, Thomas thrusting his hand in his side and so forth, do you think he was really torn up in addition to those, the side wound and the hands and feet wounds? Now, that's speculation, I know, but I'm just curious your thoughts.
I don't know, but I'm assuming that the clothing Jesus was wearing after his resurrection would cover most of the scars on his back and arms and so forth. You know, he showed them his hands and his side. Depending on what kind of robe he was wearing, he could probably pull it open to show the scar in his side. But since they whipped him, with his shirt off, and the scars were all over his back, it's not, we don't have any record of him showing them the scars on his back. So I don't know. I assume they were still there.
Okay, interesting. Well, thanks for answering my question.
Okay, Kyle, good talking to you again.
Thank you.
God bless you. Thanks for calling. Bye now.
Bye.
All right, we'll talk next to Jose from Las Vegas, Nevada. We also have a line open for you if you'd like to call 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Jose, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I got a couple of questions. The first one is it okay, is it biblically okay to worship Mary or venerate her, like the Catholics say, and the saints? Is that okay with according to what the Bible teaches?
Well, no, the Bible doesn't teach anything about venerating Mary. that comes up later in Catholic tradition. Mary in the Bible is a godly woman, a godly young woman, and apparently that would be one reason that God chose her to carry the Messiah in her womb. But Roman Catholics have made very much of her, especially her life after Jesus was born. Now, after Jesus was born, and especially after he left home, Mary does not figure very importantly in the Bible. She's sometimes with Jesus when he's traveling, and sometimes she's not. And he sometimes is in disagreement with her. For example, when she and the brothers want to come and take him into custody because they think he's gone mad in Mark chapter 3, and Jesus will not grant her an audience with him because he knows she's there on a mission that he doesn't approve of. Or on another occasion when she came to him about the need for wine at the wedding feast, his first commenter was, "Woman, what is that to me and you?" In other words, "I'm not on your schedule," is what I think he's saying. "And I have, he said, "my hour has not yet come. I have the right time to do what I have to do, and it's not going to be related to your requests necessarily." On one occasion, a woman in the crowd, hearing Jesus speak, shouted out, "Blessed is the womb that bore you and the breasts that nursed you," which is another way of saying blessed is Mary, of course, his mother. And Jesus said, "No, but more blessed are those who hear the word of God and do it." Now, there's really nothing in the New Testament that indicates after Jesus was born and after he grew up that Mary had any special role in the Christian community. She was there. She is mentioned as being in the crowd of 120 in the upper room on the day of Pentecost, but she's not mentioned as if she was special there. She's mentioned by name along with his brothers and the disciples and some other people. So she's treated just like any other Christian. You never find ever in the book of Acts that the disciples looked Mary up to get her permission to do something or to ask her to ask, you know, to pray for them or anything like that. If they did such things, it's not recorded. And if Christians should do such things, that also is not recorded. And therefore, it seems to me that the veneration of Mary is something that arose at a time when the church became paganized, in my understanding. After Constantine became a Christian, the emperor, the Christian faith adopted a lot of pagan ideas, including the veneration of the Mother of God. And there were many statues already in the Roman world of a goddess mother holding an infant on her lap, who is one of the gods. And after the conversion of Constantine, these images, these statues and so forth, and eventually were associated with Mary and Jesus. And as time went by, Mary was treated almost like she was a goddess. Now, the Roman Catholics would say they don't see her as a goddess. They would say they don't worship her. They venerate her. But I'm not really sure what the difference is, and I'm not sure the average Roman Catholic who venerates her would know what he would do differently if he was worshiping her. I don't really know what the difference is. But anyway, that would be my answer to your first question. You had a second?
It's just that I come from Mexico, and in Mexico, most of the Catholics, they don't know anything about the Bible, they don't know anything about Jesus, but they worship Mary. Mary is in every house, and they pray to her, and then, I don't know, but for me, I think that's idolatry. I don't know if I'm right.
I agree with you. Now, I don't know that every Catholic who reveres Mary at a certain level is really elevating her to a goddess-like status. But I think the Roman Catholic Church often encourages people to do that. And even where it does not, the folk religion of especially Latin American Catholics often just elevates her to a position definitely above Jesus. Now, the Roman Catholics say, no, she's not above Jesus. That's not what we teach. It may not be what you teach, but it is what is practiced. As you said, most Latin American Catholics, they venerate Mary more than they venerate Jesus. Or if they venerate them both at a similar level, they do so, I think, both of them in a rather superstitious manner, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, my second question was about why was Satan fighting with Michael, or one of the angels, for the body of Moses?
Well, that's mentioned only once. Jude. That's only mentioned once in the book of Jude in verse 9.
Uh-huh.
That Satan contended with Michael over the body of Moses, and Michael said to him, the Lord rebuke you, Satan. I don't know much about that story because it's not found anywhere else in the Bible, and Jude refers to it as if it's a familiar story to his readers. It's not like he's revealing some new information that they didn't know. He's giving illustrations from the Old Testament and other places that will illustrate a point he wants to make, and that is that you don't want to you don't want to speak too boldly against authority. He said even angels don't speak too boldly against even Satan.
Uh-huh.
And he gives that story as an example, as if it's a familiar story to his readers,
mm-hmm.
as an illustration. Now, it was a familiar story, but it wasn't from the Bible. It was apparently from a book that is now no longer available, but it was popular back then. It's a book called The Assumption of Moses. Now, the reason I say that is because the historian Eusebius lived in the 300s, early 300s A.D., and he was familiar with that book. That book was still around in his day, and he says that Jude was referring to a story that was in this other book called The Assumption of Moses, which was not a biblical book. It was not an inspired book. And that book, The Assumption of Moses, no longer exists, so we can't even read the story in its original form and know what the alleged dispute was about. So your question really can't be answered, as far as I know.
Can I give you my suspicion?
Go ahead.
My suspicion is that, remember when Moses left for 40 days and they worshiped the golden idol?
Yeah.
I think that he was going to get the body of Moses and he was going to set it up for the people to worship it, kind of like the Catholics do with Mary or something like that. That's my suspicion. I think I might be wrong, but that's my suspicion.
Well, you know, your theory is probably as good as any others, because we don't really know what the truth is about it. But it certainly is human nature to worship leaders. And Moses was a dynamic leader, so there could have been people who would have worshipped him. Some people believe that's why no one knows where Moses was buried. The Bible says when it came time for Moses to die, God told Moses to go up on the mountain, and he left the people, and God took his life and buried his body in a place that no one knows. That's what it says. And some people think that God did that because he did not want the tomb of Moses to become a place where people went to worship the remains of Moses.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Steve, and I hope you have a happy Thanksgiving, and God bless you.
Okay, Hosea, same to you.
Bye-bye.
God bless you. Bye now. All right, our next call is from Brad in Littleton, Colorado. If you'd like to give me a call, the number is 1-800-438-5090. My name is Steve Gregg. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. The number, again, if you want to call me here, is 1-800-438-5090. Brad, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I have a question about imprecatory prayer.
Okay.
So there's an acquaintance I have who's he's going to go in for some kind of medical procedure to determine if he has something very serious. And so I thought, I should pray for him. But just now, then I thought, well, I'm not so clear on that, because this is somebody who is almost violently opposed to Christ and anything Christian. He's the kind of person that sometimes get, you know, in your face with his, you know, veins popping out of his forehead, cussing and so forth. And so I thought, I wonder if there's anything to that. I mean, so I started reviewing some scriptures, and, you know, here, and I thought of Paul in 2 Thessalonians 4, where he says, you know, may the Lord repay...
2 Timothy 4, yeah. Mm-hmm.
2 Timothy, okay. Right. Repay Alexander according to his works, because he defied the gospel.
Right.
And then I had a note on that one referring me back to 2 Chronicles 19:2, where it says, should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord?
Mm.
Obviously speaking rhetorically. And then I thought about the imprecatory psalms, and I also thought about the saints under the altar in Revelation asking for vengeance on those who were still alive. And then when I looked at Jesus' words, I see that he says, pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you, but he doesn't say pray for those who, you know, are against me,
uh-huh,
as in him. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, for the sake of our listeners who don't know the expression imprecatory, there are a group of psalms in the Old Testament that are usually called imprecatory psalms, and the word imprecation means wishing evil on somebody. It's like uttering a curse against them. And some of the psalms actually wish evil on certain wicked people. And they're some of the more uncomfortable psalms to read for someone who's got a sensitive spirit, because they wish really harsh things on bad people. And they are prayers. They are really prayers that God will punish bad people in certain ways. And some people think, well, that's really out of line for New Testament Christianity. But as you mentioned, Paul prayed an imprecatory prayer against Alexander the coppersmith because he had resisted the gospel. And the saints in heaven, in Revelation chapter 6, their souls are seen in heaven praying, or at least urging God to hasten to bring vengeance on those who have slain them. So there is a legitimate place, apparently, in the New Testament and the Old to pray that God will punish the wicked. The problem is we don't know about any given wicked person whether that person is potentially a saint or not, because any wicked person might become a Christian. Just think of how tempted the early Christians might have been and may have even done to pray imprecations against Saul of Tarsus, who then later became Paul. If they were praying for his death, I'll bet they later regretted that they had prayed for that, since he later became a great champion of the Christian faith himself. And it's hard to say. I would say in a case like that, when you're uncertain, I would just say, God, your will be done in this situation. In fact, your will be done can be an imprecatory prayer itself. Because Jesus, right, when you pray, say, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Well, if God's will is going to be done on earth as it is in heaven, that's going to be at the expense of those who are resisting his will being done. And whether that means they change their mind or they have to be mowed down by God, I don't know.
I've always thought kind of strange if I say, okay, Lord, in this situation, your will be done. I'm always struggled with how that's any different than wake up in the morning and just saying, Lord, your will be done, and everywhere and every time. You know what I mean?
That's just it. Sometimes we don't know what his will is.
Yeah.
And you don't know if your friend is going to become a great Christian through this crisis, or if this is God's way of taking him out because he's a perpetual and incurable enemy of God. We don't know those things that God knows, and therefore I would be, you know, if ever I would pray imprecatory prayers, it would be in the most general sense about God, you know, removing the opposition to his will in certain sectors where I see it, but not necessarily praying specific evils on individuals, though Paul did pray that way about Alexander the coppersmith. You know, I'm not saying it's wrong to do it. I'm just saying I don't know that I would have the wisdom to know when to do it.
Maybe he had more of a revelation than the average Christian would or something.
It's very possible, yeah.
Okay, I have one more question if there's time.
Okay, I think there is.
Okay, two things that are true about us as Christians is that we are children of a father, and we're also slaves of a master. And when I was thinking about that the other day, I thought, well, those are almost mutually exclusive. And would you have any thoughts about how those are reconciled, if that makes, I don't know, maybe that's just too vague of a question, but...
Well, it's not mutually exclusive in the sense that, I mean, in some respects it is. In some respects, a child has more rights than the average slave would have. Although it says in Proverbs that a slave who is diligent and is wise will actually exercise rule over a son who is a fool. So a son may lose privileges, and a slave may gain them, if depending on the householder's assessment of their relative behavior. But I would say, you know, when Jesus said in John chapter 15, I call you no longer servants, but friends, because a friend, he says, a servant doesn't know what his master's up to, but I have told you everything that my Father's told me. In other words, I've brought you into my confidence in a way that, that a man doesn't usually bring his slaves into his confidence, but only his friends. But then Jesus said, you are my friends if you do everything I've commanded you to do.
Right.
And so we are friends, but we are still obliged to be obedient to him. We are in a sense, slaves that have been befriended. Or you could say slaves that have been adopted. And therefore, there is still the sovereignty of the master over us, even though he may give us privileges as friends or as children. But there's still, I mean, children, it used to be, and now in our society we don't take this for granted, but it used to be in society that children looked to their fathers a little bit like slaves looked to a master. I mean, the father might be kind, he might be affectionate, and so forth, but the honor that was due him was considered to be not really less than was due to a master by a slave. In fact, that seems to be pointed out, or at least alluded to, in the book of Malachi, in the very opening statements that God makes in Malachi. He says, let me turn there here. He says in verse 6 of Malachi 1, a son honors his father, and a servant honors his master. If then I am a father, where is my honor? If I'm a master, where's my reverence? Says the Lord of hosts. Mm-hmm. Now, he's basically saying fathers and masters receive reverence from their children and their slaves, as if the way that a child is to honor his father is not very different from the way that a slave is to honor his master. What is different is the degree that the master is invested in his slave, or that a father is invested in his children. The children are to honor their father as much as a slave is to honor a master. But a father is more invested in his children than he is in his slaves, and has more care for them generally, at least in that society, one would expect. So, you know,
of course, a slave owner could be a benevolent slave owner.
Oh, in fact, they were commanded to be in the Bible. Yeah. You know, slave owners in the Bible were required to be benevolent.
We just can't see that in this country, given our history.
Yeah, we're more familiar with racially based slavery, where people were kidnapped from their homes in Africa and treated as if they were not human.
Right.
That's the kind of slavery that took place in this country that everyone's so ashamed of now. But in biblical times, slavery was often your neighbor who couldn't pay his bills asked you to buy him as a slave so he could be out of debt, you know, and so he became your slave. It was not it wasn't a kidnapping situation where one race of people was enslaving another race of people. Slavery, as we've known it in this country, is an entirely different, has many different moral differences than
now,
slavery in biblical times.
The kind of slavery that you just spoke of now has been replaced by becoming slaves to the government if they can't pay their bills.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we still have slavery. I mean,
right.
Frankly, there are people who are slaves to their jobs. They work a grinding, low-wage job, but they don't have any choice. If they quit their job, they wouldn't have any food. So, I mean, a slave in those days who had a generous master might actually enjoy his life more than some people in a free country who can't pay their bills, even though they're free men.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much for that, and have a good Thanksgiving. God bless you.
All right, Brad. God bless you. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye now. All right, we have an anonymous call from Alexandria, Virginia. Now, I know somebody in Alexandria, Virginia. This may be from that party or from someone else, but welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. My question, I'll just describe a little bit of the background. I grew up in a church that was pretty liberal, and my dad was the minister there. And I guess recently I've been wondering, there's been situations in the church, and there might even be now, where people have been walking in sin, and and they're not really exhorted to repent or to change their lifestyle. And because my family is so involved in the church, I still go, you know, at Christmas and at Easter and things. And I'm just wondering what would the Bible teach about the best response to that? Like, you know, I know it says that if someone calls themselves a brother and they're walking in sin, you're not supposed to be sort of associated with them. But then on the other hand, I think a lot of people at the church are not really true believers. So I'm just wondering what's the best sort of way to relate. And also, too, about, you know, taking communion there.
Yeah. Well, I get asked this from time to time by people who have families who are, you know, ostensibly Christian. They're church people. They may be liberal or they may be compromised in some way. And they wonder, you know, can we have Thanksgiving dinner with these people? I mean, it does say in 1 Corinthians 5 that if someone calls himself a Christian and they live in certain kinds of sin, fornication, drunkenness, idolatry, and so forth, that you shouldn't even eat with such a person. But I personally don't think that this is referring to people having meals with their own families. I believe this is talking about the church's welcoming or not welcoming people into their fold, into the love feast. The love feast was the center of the Christian worship in the first century, and that's where they'd take communion and they'd share a meal together. And it was a big family gathering of the spiritual family. And that was where some people were supposed to be excluded if they were just taking advantage of the welcome the church was giving them, but they're also living in a way that a Christian should not live. Now, it's a different situation, I think, if someone is your biological family, because there are obligations to honor your father and mother. Jesus indicated that that's a continuing obligation. And it can be difficult. It can be difficult because you have to disagree at times with your father and mother, especially when they're, you know, quite wrong about their whole religion. But you have to disagree honorably. And I don't think that when you take a meal with people like you've just described, I don't think that you are necessarily compromising or violating what 1 Corinthians 5 is talking about. Because 1 Corinthians 5 is talking about church discipline. And a family meal, I think, of a nuclear family or an extended biological family is a different kind of situation than what Paul was addressing. And I think that family relationships can be broken by the faith of the believer, but they should be broken from the other side. When Jesus said, I came to bring a division between, you know, parents and their children and things like that, I don't think he meant that the children who became Christians would alienate themselves from their parents on purpose, but rather that the members of the family that didn't become Christians would exclude those who did. I don't think that Christians are supposed to abandon their families unless their families are going to require them to not really follow Christ. As far as, you know, the sins that your family's involved in, I don't know that you're saying that your father and your mother and siblings are actually involved in sinful behavior, but that they tolerate it in the church or they don't exercise church discipline. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's not necessarily them, but just that the practice of the church in general.
Yeah. In a case like that, I would say that there's nothing in the Bible that says you can't eat with people who disagree with you on religious subjects. If your parents were, you know, involved in some of the blatant sins that Paul lists, it might even be that having a meal with them as family would not be a violation of what Paul has in mind, but it'd come closer to being relevant.
What about like having communion at the church and, you know?
If this is a church where the gospel is not preached and the people mm-hmm. are not Christian, I mean, they're not disciples of Jesus. They've never been challenged to repent and to come to Christ as disciples, then it's really hardly a church at all. And what they serve is hardly communion. And I would myself probably not participate in it. Now, how do they do it? Do they pass the elements around? Do they have people come forward to a table?
They do it both ways. It varies.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it might be possible for you to just pass the elements by and not be too ostentatious about it and not participate, right?
Yeah, except if they called people forward, then it would be pretty noticeable, I guess.
That would be a little more noticeable, yeah. Well, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, if they are not true Christians, what they are serving is not true communion, but it's not the table of devils either. It's not like when Paul said you can't eat at the table of the Lord and the table of devils, he meant you can't go into the idol temples and eat the meat that's been sacrificed to idols. Even though these people may not be what the Bible calls true Christians, they certainly are not deliberately worshiping idols. They think they're Christians. They think they're honoring Christ. And I would think that if you partook of the bread and the wine, it wouldn't hurt anything. I don't think you're doing anything that would, somehow make God upset with you.
Is there any, I guess part of my fear would be, confirming to them, yes, we're all Christians, we all follow Christ, if I participate with them, you know?
It might say that to them. That might be the message they would get from it. It depends on how they understand communion. I think there's a variety of ways that Christians understand what's going on at communion, and some might think that way about it. If I were to participate in something like that, I would not, in doing so, I would not be actually trying to communicate the message that I accept that all these people around me are true Christians. In fact, I can't even do that at a conservative church. When I take communion at a conservative church, I'm not sure that everyone in the pew with me is a true Christian.
Right.
I'm simply saying I am. I'm a follower of Christ, and I'm participating with the body of Christ worldwide in the commemoration of the body and blood of Jesus. That's how I would see it.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That's helpful.
All right. Well, I appreciate your call. And I think I think you are the person I know.
Yeah, I think I am. I
or related by marriage. Yeah.
Oh, well.
All right.
Okay, thanks.
But no one else knows who you are. Okay. God bless you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right. Let's talk to Kathy from Las Vegas, Nevada. Kathy, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes. Is this Jose's Kathy? Or different
Pardon
Kathy?
Me?
Is this Jose's wife, Kathy, or different Kathy?
No, this is Scott's wife, Kathy.
Okay, because I have another friend named Kathy married to my friend Jose in Las Vegas, so I didn't know who I'm talking to. Okay. Welcome.
Okay. I would say that for probably the first 20 years of my Christian life, I would be what you would classify a dispensationalist.
Okay.
And I realized that I don't believe that way anymore. And a lot of people, basically have called me a heretic for not believing in a separate pre-tribulation surprise rapture. And it was so refreshing to hear you talk about that with your first caller on the program because, you know, There's a stigma about it or something. But lately, the last few years, we've been involved with a group, where I learned this position that, you know, there's probably not going to be a rapture as the dispensationalists have taught it. It's part of an out branch or something of the Latter Rain movement.
Oh.
And they,
is this the walk?
You know, They're almost considered heretics, just
yeah.
Like, you know, preterists are in some circles. So I just like to hear your explanation, the good, the bad, the ugly.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's some things that I'm not totally convinced about, and then there's some things that are really great and I embrace. So I'd like to take your call off the air because I'm on my cell phone daytime minutes and I'm driving.
Okay, well, let me ask you something before you're gone. Is
okay.
The group you're fellowship with, is it The Walk? Is it the John Robert Stevens group?
No.
Okay. But it's come out of the Latter Rain movement.
Well, yeah, William Branham and all that.
Yes, so they're manifested sons of God, probably.
Yeah, it's really big nowadays. They don't call it that.
Yeah.
But names like Todd Bentley from Lakeland, Patricia King, Bill Johnson from the church in Redding.
Yeah, I mean, Paul Kane.
Yeah. Yeah, all them guys. So I just like to hear the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Okay. Well, we only have a few minutes, so I'll try to give you a little something.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, Kathy. Thanks for your call.
Okay.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Well, in rejecting dispensationalism, there are more than one option you can go to. And I don't necessarily think that the Latter Rain movement is accurate. The Manifested Sons of God doctrine, as Branham taught it, and as some others in more modern times who revere him have taught it, actually teaches that the sons of God, the true overcoming Christians, will in this life receive their glorified bodies. They will, not in the resurrection, but while they're still alive, they'll receive glorified bodies. They'll be able to pass through walls like Jesus did when he was resurrected and things like that. These are some of the things that were taught by the early Latter Rain teachers and which I've heard still are taught by some of the modern ones. I don't know whether Todd Bentley is teaching that, but Todd Bentley I've got problems with anyway. Anyone who kicks old women in the face as a means of healing them is not very much on the same page with Jesus Christ, I don't think. So I have problems with that movement that you're associating with now, too. When I left dispensationalism, I didn't know what it was I had gone to because I had studied the Bible on my own, and it led me out of dispensationalism, led me away from the pre-trib rapture and all of that. But I later found out that the view I had reached was the view which is usually called Reformed theology, except for the Calvinism. I'm not a Calvinist. Reformed people are usually Calvinistic and amillennial or postmillennial. My view happens to be amillennial, but I'm not a Calvinist. But what I found out, and it was comforting to find out, was that when I reached a view that I thought was heretical and that all my people I'd been around and the teacher I'd been around probably would have called it heretical, that I was glad to find it was the historic view of the church since the time at least of Augustine and before Augustine, at least 100 years before Augustine. It was taught by people like Origen and the Alexandrian school of Christianity. But the point is, it was the major view of the church through the whole Middle Ages and through the Reformation. But it was not this manifest sense of God thing. The manifest sense of God doctrine, I believe, arose in the 1940s, if I'm not mistaken. And William Branham, a colorful character, had a lot of power in his ministry, apparently. But it's not entirely clear that that power is from God. The man made some strange claims. He thought he was Elijah the prophet and so forth, come back. But I'm not very comfortable with that movement. And I know it's very popular in some circles. It's making a resurgence now. But I think it's making a resurgence among those who are kind of looking for something spectacular, something sensational. I would certainly say, read the Gospels, saturate your mind in the Gospels, look at Jesus, hear what he said, and follow what he said, and you'll find that there's not an awful lot of sensationalism there. There's just righteous, godly, sacrificial living recommended, and find people who are doing the same thing. People who get on trips like the Latter-day movement, they're trying to ride at the crest of a wave. They want to be on the cutting edge of what God's doing in the end times. The trouble is, if you want to be on that cutting edge, they keep coming up with new things they say belong to that edge, and then you have to go through one fad after another, and they do that. They're very faddish in their approach to Christianity. You can't go wrong if you just stick with what Jesus said and follow him in a sincere and primitive manner, and that's what I would highly recommend. I'd like to say more, but I'm going to be cut off the air in 30 seconds, so I just need to say The Narrow Path is a ministry that is listener-supported, and if you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. If you haven't been to the website, go there. It's thenarrowpath.com. My name is Steve Gregg. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again after Thanksgiving.